By late summer of 2001, a year and a half into their investigation into the murders at the Fulton game area, the cold case team began closing in an arrest. They issued an investigative subpoena to Jeff Titus, requiring him to attend a hearing at the prosecutor's office and answer questions about the case under oath. At the end of that hearing, the cold case detectives had been outside waiting for him.
Anyway, I went over for a guest investigative subpoena. Then when I come out, he said, "Titus, we have a search warrant for your place." And then we drove to my house. And then we pulled in. Well, there was the bomb squad, the FBI, and all of them were there at my house waiting. So they were already there waiting when I got home. And then they divided up the places and went through.
Because of all the rumors about the Titus farm being booby-trapped, the cold case team had wanted Jeff to return home before they started their search. They'd wanted him to open up the doors and make sure there are no surprises waiting for them. Detective Mike Brown had been confident that the search team would turn up evidence to link him to the Fulton game area murders.
Well, would Titus listen when they got a search warrant for his house? Mm-hmm. I told Mike, I says, "When you search that house, you're going to find trophies. You're going to find trophies. He's a trophy saver."
Sure enough, during the search, investigators were able to find a collection of articles from the local paper about the Fulton game area murders, including the one in which his picture appeared, beside the story of how he found the gun. Though this collection of newspaper articles wasn't just about the murders, there were also articles on other topics too, like the local fur trade. Articles in which Titus had been quoted as a source, where his name had otherwise appeared in connection with the story.
You take the newspaper articles I had. So like I say, it's something that happened there at the farm I was involved with, so I kept them. Now, they would call that, "Oh, those are trophies. You're trying to, you know, keep them from saying, you know, you did this and these are your trophies."
Investigators also recovered a book and some movies on VHS form from Titus's house. The Kalamazoo County Sheriff's Office still has them. They were there when Susan reviewed the case file with one of the deputies.
Been books,
that's the sniper video.
Books found in her videos.
Yeah.
Good movie.
Dead Center.
Dead Center is the title of a paperback that investigators seized at Titus's house. According to the cover, it's a book about, quote, "a Marine sniper's two-year odyssey in the Vietnam War." There were also two VHS tapes of two different movies, both of which are titled Sniper. During the search, investigators also found a hand-drawn map of a selection of the Fulton game area. It's a fairly crude drawing, but the location of Titus's fields are marked, as are his neighbor's property lines, and then there are a few X's and swooping lines marking out certain places in the Fulton game area. It appears to be a sketch of the crime scene. To some members of the cold case team, Titus's possession of a sketch of the crime scene was further evidence of his guilt. Cold case detective Rich Madison did not agree with him.
And one of their guys found what would purport to be a crime scene sketch. And that was, you know, that was recovered and used as evidence. When you look at it, the placement of the bodies is wrong.
I've seen it. It's not.
Yeah, it's not accurate.
On the crime scene sketch, Titus has drawn an X that accurately marks out the spot where he says he found Doug Estes' shotgun. But there's some other X's that appear to be marking where the bodies have been found, and they're way off. They're not at all where they would be on the sketch. And Detective Madison remembers that during the search, he had found something else in Titus's property that the cold case team had not included in their list of evidence.
He was going to this little town and passed a dairy farm and saw some dead cows, cattle, and whatever, with some snow on them. So he calls the Calhoun County Sheriff's Department, Calhoun County Animal Control, and I think it was Channel 17 out of Battle Creek, which is an NBC affiliate. He gets all of them coming. Anyway, the cop didn't have a camera. And Jeff stayed right there with him. So what I found was a crime scene sketch, notes, and a police-style report that was even signed, respectfully submitted, Jeff E. Titus. He wrote his own police report.
Thank you.
welcome to the Undisclosed Podcast. This is episode 10 of our series in the case of Jeff Titus out of Kalamazoo, Michigan. My name is Susan Simpson. I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C., and I blog at The View from LL2. I'm here this week with my colleague, Colin Miller.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog.
Case team, the physical items that they found during the search of Jeff Titus' farm had not been the only important evidence they obtained that day. Because Jeff's behavior during the search, they said, had also been incriminating.
You should have seen Titus when we were, Mike and I were sitting in his front yard in a lawn chair with him sitting next to us. The guys were going through the house. He went to his car and got a book and he started reading the book. And he wasn't just non-emotional at all.
There's a grainy black and white photo that we have that was taken to the scene that Mike Brown is describing. It shows Detectives Brown and Workema sitting out in lawn chairs in Titus's front yard, with Titus in a lawn chair beside them, a book in his hands.
You know, them pointing out, the detectives thinking that the behavior was odd, reading a book. Any comment about that?
Well, I don't know. I can't really say. I just sat down and started reading the book. I had no place else to go. I mean, as my attorney told me, he said, just go on home and turn around and wait there while they do their search. Because he said that they had a search warrant to search our place.
While out there in the yard, Detective Workema began trying to question Jeff. And as Workema testified at trial, Jeff's answer to Workema's very first question had inadvertently revealed Jeff's guilt.
And he said that one of the things that stood out in his mind is he said, you know what we're doing here, or something like that. And your response was, hoping I'll slip up.
Yep.
So tell me what you meant when you told Workema that, you know, you're hoping I'll slip up. What did you mean by that?
Well, he's trying to make me ask me questions so that I say something different than what I've always said. So he wanted me to slip up. I mean, I'm not going to change my story because this is what happened. I didn't do it. And I'm not going to do nothing that says that I did because I didn't do it.
According to the cold case team, Jeff Titus's answer had itself been a slip up.
When he was asked, you know why we're here? He says, yeah, you're hoping I'll slip up. That's an incriminating statement. He didn't say, I'm innocent. He didn't say, you're barking up the wrong tree. He didn't say anything that an innocent man would have said.
As prosecutor Stu Fenton explained, only someone who's guilty could possibly have realized that you can slip up and give an incriminating answer. That thought would never occur to someone who's innocent. It's worth noting that Prosecutor Fenton is criticizing Titus here for correctly answering Detective Workema's question. Workema was, in fact, hoping that Titus would slip up, as Titus had realized. With this evidence only further solidifying their confidence in Jeff Titus's guilt, it was a matter of time before the cold case team moved in to make an arrest.
And then on December 12th, I get arrested when they come to my house early in the morning and have me come outside. And then they throw me in cuffs, and then that's the last time I was ever in my house.
At the time of his arrest, Jeff Titus already had an attorney. He'd hired Ward McDonough to represent him for the hearing at the prosecutor's office. But when Jeff Titus was arrested and charged with murder, McDonough, whose primary practice was in family law, had realized he was going to need some help. He'd brought on criminal attorney Bill Fetty as his co-counsel.
And you pay. He wasn't appointed to you. You hired him, correct?
Right. Well, I hired McDougal, and then he said, "Well, we're getting this. We want to get Fetty to turn around, do the case, because I don't have that much experience in criminal, and he does." So he was the one that picked him.
I think the point is you paid him for his expertise. So you.
Yep, $40,000 for the two of them.
It was actually Titus's wife and her parents who'd put the money together to hire the defense team. A defense investigator named Howard Swabash was also brought on to help investigate Titus's case and to prepare for trial. Jeff Titus was denied bail, and in the letters he wrote from jail over the next 7 months, he doesn't talk about his case much. When he does mention it, it's mostly in the context of how he can't wait for this whole thing to be over with. Quote, "I think I told you already that trial is June 11th. Wish it was sooner. I hate this place," he wrote to one friend. And to another, "Well, my jury got picked, so now sit and wait for trial. I hope it is done by the 18th. My daughter's up for homecoming queen on July 19th. Would be nice to see her get it." Jeff writes wistfully about all the food he can't wait to eat once he's finally home, and about how he hopes he and his wife Julie can go on vacation together once he's free, just the two of them somewhere, so they could spend some time away from all of it for a bit. In all the letters that Jeff sent and wrote before his trial, there's really only one that has any significance to his case. It's a letter that he received about 6 weeks after this arrest, dated February 1st, 2000. "Dear Mr. Titus," the letter began, "I'm writing to tell you that I know you did not kill the two men in the state game area. A friend of mine did. He shot them in the back while he was out hunting. His name is Charles Dean Lamp." The letter was from a man named Junior Fred Blackston. Blackston explains that in late 1990, his friend Lamp had told him about an argument he'd had out in the woods. The argument had escalated and had ended with Lamp shooting two hunters in the back with a shotgun. Blackston told Titus that he felt certain that the murders that Lamp had described to him all those years ago were the same murders that Titus had been arrested for. Blackston's letter went on, "I'm in prison for a murder that Lamp did back in 1988. The cold case team made a deal with Mr. Lamp to put this murder on me. I went to trial by jury because I knew I was not the killer, but I was found guilty." Blackston warned Jeff about what he could expect at his upcoming trial. "The jury is most likely to believe whatever the prosecutor tells them," he said. "I do not want you to be found guilty for a murder that Mr. Lamp did. And it can happen. It did to me."
Late one evening in September of 1988, 22-year-old Charlie Miller walked into the forest with three other men: Junior Fred Blackston, Charles Dean Lamp, and Carl Simpson. The four of them had been heading out to steal a marijuana crop that was growing back there. Or at least that's where Charlie Miller had thought they'd been heading. When Lamp, Simpson, and Blackston walked out of the woods a few hours later, Miller was not with them. He would remain missing for the next 12 years.
I don't know if, you know, it was vengeance or trying to take over his business. I don't know.
It's unclear.
I don't know what the motive was. But they had pre-dug the hole to the grave, lured him out there, and, you know, shot him and just buried him.
That's cold case detective Rich Madison, who had heard about the murder case from the Michigan State Police that investigated it. Technically, it had been a missing persons case when it began, but there'd never really been any mystery about what happened to Charlie Miller. The three friends he'd been with that night had all made comments to others about how Charlie was never coming back, and that something had happened to him back in the woods. Miller had gotten over his head with the wrong people, they'd explained. The evidence had suggested that a local coke dealer had hired Lamp and Blackston to kill Miller over an unpaid drug debt. Miller had owed either a couple hundred or a couple $1,000, depending on who you asked. Within a few months of the murder, Carl Simpson had tried to confess to his role in it. He went to the police and gave them a detailed statement explaining how he, Lamp, and Blackston had taken Miller out into the woods, killed him, and buried him in a pre-dug grave. But Simpson had not been able to corroborate his story. He'd taken detectives back into the forest where he said Miller was buried, but try as he might, Simpson could not find the burial site again. 10 years later, while in prison on unrelated charges, Charles Dean Lamp had also confessed his involvement in Charlie Miller's death. He'd had the exact same problem Carl Simpson did, though. He couldn't find the grave. This time, though, investigators had a new trick up their sleeve.
I saw pictures of when they dug him up.
How did they find him? It took like 10 years.
Yeah, well, one of the suspects took him out and pointed out where he was, generally. Mm-hmm. And I remember him telling us that they raked all the debris off the woods floor and had big, tall ladders. And it's the first time I'd heard of it. But as a body decays, you know, it gives nutrients to the forest floor. And the area turns dark. So they were setting up ladders and whatnot and, you know, looking down, and they could see this weird dark outline. And they said, right there. And they dug it up, and there he was.
Although the general events leading up to Charlie Miller's murder were clear enough, the specifics of what had happened were not. Investigators knew that Simpson, Blackston, and Lamp had been involved, but they hadn't known which of the three men had actually killed Miller and didn't know whose idea the whole thing had been. Ultimately, the state cut a deal with both Lamp and Simpson, who testified at Blackston's trial that Blackston had been the one to actually shoot and kill Charlie Miller. Blackston was convicted and sentenced to life in prison. That conviction had been quickly overturned, though, when it was discovered that the prosecution had misled the jury as to just how generous the deal had been for Carl Simpson. He'd been given full immunity from prosecution in exchange for testifying that it was Blackston, not Lamp, who was the shooter. Blackston was retried and convicted once again, and that conviction, too, was overturned. Finally, in 2016, rather than go to trial for a third time, Blackston had agreed to a plea deal that would allow for his release after serving a little over 20 years in prison. Titus passed the letter he'd gotten from Blackston on to his attorneys, and for the next 4 months, the defense team's efforts to prepare for Titus's trial were focused on the allegations against Charles Dean Lamp. Defense investigator Howard Swabesh interviewed both Blackston and Lamp, and as Jeff's friend and hunting companion Stan Driscoll recalls, Swabesh had come away from this investigation seemingly convinced that Charles Dean Lamp was the true culprit in the case.
There's a man named Charles Lamp that people talk about.
My understanding is Swabesh did some kind of investigation of one of these two people, and I believe he thought he had found the person who actually did the crime. This is a man that would have substance in terms of doing criminal investigation. So if he said that, I think this man probably is the culprit, the Kalamazoo police, the cold case team, should have vigorously followed up on that.
The cold case team did vigorously follow up on the allegations made by Blackston. Their investigation into Lamp was far more comprehensive than anything the defense team did. And following their investigation, the cold case team put together a convincing case that Lamp had absolutely nothing to do with the murders of the Fulton Game area, and that Blackston's letter had been nothing more than an attempt to get revenge against the man who had turned state's evidence against him. From my own investigation, I have seen nothing that would lead me to disagree with the cold case team's conclusions on this.
When Junior Fred Blackston had written that letter to Jeff Titus with his story about how Charles Dean Lamp had committed the murders, he may have given Jeff some bad information, but he'd also offered some good advice. Blackston wrote,
"Please read and remember this. You need to do all you can now at trial and before trial to win, because appeals are almost impossible to get. Use all and any defense and witnesses that you can now. Your life is on the line, and you sure as hell do not want to get life for murder someone else did. It's hard to live with."
It was not advice that Jeff Titus' attorneys followed. For the next 4 months, the defense investigation focused on Charles Dean Lamp to the apparent exclusion of everything else. Howard Swabesh, the defense investigator, waited until just a few weeks before Jeff Titus' trial before interviewing other witnesses in the case. Kelly Warren, whose father was Jeff's friend Big Jack Warren, remembers that she had not been impressed by him.
But his defense attorney and that investigator was horrible. And then later I found out he was a cop. I couldn't believe that an investigator with that experience, supposed experience, would be so horrible that you wouldn't go and...
Are you talking about Swabesh? Swabesh?
I don't know his name. He's married to Julie.
Yeah. You didn't think he was very impressive.
Well, he called and talked with me, and he called and talked to my dad. Like, it was like 4 days before the trial. It was ridiculous.
Last minute.
And then you try to tell him different things that you know that weren't right.
Based on the investigation notes from defense investigator Howard Swabesh, Kelly's memory is slightly off here. He interviewed Kelly and her father 6 days before the scheduled trial date, not four. But by the time that Swabesh had gotten around to investigating the prosecution's case, there had been little to no time left and too much ground to cover. Out of the 39 witnesses the prosecution called at Titus's trial, Swabesh had spoken to only two of them.
It was the defense team's failure to contact two witnesses in particular, though, that first caused Jeff Titus to have doubts as to whether his attorney, Bill Fetty, had been providing him with good counsel.
And did you trust his advice?
Well, to a point. I mean, I thought it was, you know, this and that. And then later on, when he said he was going to call the original detectives and he didn't, no, I didn't trust him. And then later he got turned around and got disbarred for not representing his clients.
Jeff, do you think if they had called the original detectives, if they had called Rusima and Ballot to the stand, do you think we'd be talking today?
No, I don't think we would.
So why do you think the original detectives weren't called to testify?
I do not know.
Detective Roy Ballad doesn't have any answers here either, though he has a theory.
I'm curious about why you weren't called at trial. Why weren't you called?
I have no idea. I do not know why. I theorize that they knew that I would blow their case out of the water because they didn't have one.
Couldn't the defense attorney have called you?
That's what I don't understand. The defense attorney did not pay any attention of any kind. As I said, I knew him for over 30 years. I knew the investigator, knew them for years. And none of them ever contacted me or asked me any questions or advice as to what we learned in 1990.
From everything that he's seen in the case, Ballot does not believe that Titus was well served by his defense investigator, Howard Swabash.
You think he did a good job?
No. Didn't do much of anything, to be honest with you.
Detectives Rusima and Ballot would have been an invaluable resource for Titus's defense on a number of issues. But the defense's failure to contact the original investigators is even harder to explain, given that Rusima and Ballot were, effectively, alibi witnesses for Jeff Titus. In November 1990, the detectives had spoken to Eloise and Gerald Shepard, and they'd confirmed Titus's alibi. They told the detectives that, on the afternoon of the murders, Jeff and his friend Stan had been hunting at their farm north of Battle Creek. By 2002, though, at Jeff's trial, Gerald Shepard had dementia. He would not have made for a great witness. But he had no such difficulties back in 1990, when he and his wife had written and signed a statement confirming Jeff's alibi. Through Rusima and Ballot, Titus's whereabouts that day could have been confirmed. Instead, the only alibi witness that Jeff's attorneys called was Stan Driscoll, a man who, as Roy Ballot recalls, with some frustration, has a manner of speaking that wouldn't make him any attorney's first pick of a witness.
Because he could never... If you ask a person a question, they should be able to answer that specific question. It almost seems like he wants to answer a question with another question.
During motions hearings into Jeff Titus's trial, defense attorneys Ward McDonough and Bill Fetty had only two legal victories of any note. The first had been successfully blocking the prosecution from introducing into evidence the VHS tapes in the paperback book that investigators had seized during their search out at Titus's farm. According to prosecutor Scott Brower, who represented the state at trial, Titus's possession of these items had been evidence of his guilt. The VHS tapes were both movies about sniping, Brower said, and one of the movies also had information about wearing camouflage. This was relevant evidence for the purpose of proving that Titus was the only madman who ran around the Fulton game area in camouflage and threatened hunters that he encountered. The book about the sniper in the Vietnam War was a particularly relevant piece of evidence, he said, because it demonstrated Titus's interest in shooting people one time and killing them. And that's exactly how the victims in this case had been killed, with one shot each. And most importantly, the prosecutor told the court, the title of this book was Dead Center, which is relevant, quote, in light of the fact that the victims were shot dead center right in the middle of the back in almost identical positions in each victim, right through the licenses of each of the victims. Now I'll just note for the sake of accuracy that the factual premise of Brower's argument here is false. The victims weren't shot through the center of their back licenses. The edge of Estes's tag was clipped, and Bennett's tag doesn't seem to have been hit at all. Defense attorney Bill Fetty objected to this evidence, arguing the movies in the book would only be relevant if the victims in this case had been shot at long distance. Snipers shoot things that are far away, and the victims in the game area had been shot at short range. Ultimately, the judge ruled in favor of the defense, though not for the reasons that Fetty had argued. The judge concluded there was no evidence the movies and book had belonged to Jeff Titus, as opposed to someone else who lived in his household. It's possible they might have belonged to his daughters or his wife. Therefore, the judge ruled they were not admissible.
The defense's second legal victory came when they successfully excluded the testimony of one of the witnesses who told the cold case team that he'd been hunting out in the Fulton game area when Jeff Titus had confronted and threatened him. There were three men in all with stories like this who the prosecution wanted to have testify. All of them had talked about encountering someone in the woods under very similar circumstances, but only one of those three men, a guy named David Neufer, had actually been asked to identify Jeff Titus in a lineup. But David Neufer hadn't been able to. He couldn't pick out Titus as the man who had threatened him. Prosecutor Scott Brower argued that David Neufer should be allowed to testify at trial anyway. His story had been so similar to what the other witnesses had described, Brower argued to the court, that it was obvious Neufer had been threatened by the same man that had threatened the others. His inability to identify Titus at the lineup didn't change anything about that. But defense attorney Ward McDonough argued that Neufer's failure to identify Titus meant that he shouldn't be allowed to testify at all. And McDonough had won. The judge ruled that David Neufer would not be permitted to testify at Titus's trial. One of the prosecution's more damning pieces of evidence against Jeff Titus had come from the testimony of a married couple, Marion and Lee Gibbs, who owned a sawmill a little ways north of Fulton. At trial, they testified that just 3 or 4 days after the murders, Jeff Titus had come by their sawmill with some lumber he wanted cut into planks. The discussion had quickly taken a dark turn, though, as Titus began to describe how two men had been killed near his farm. Lee and Marion Gibbs testified to a roughly similar set of events, but by the time of trial, Lee's memory of this conversation with Titus had become somewhat vague and indistinct. It was Marion who had the much clearer memory of what had happened. She described in vivid detail what Titus had told her and her husband about the men who were killed out near his farm. For the prosecution, the most significant part of Marion's testimony had to do with what Titus said about the two hunters. Marion said that Titus had told them about how, earlier that day before they died, the two men had been trespassing on his property. "I had to kick those sons of bitches off my land," Marion says Titus had told them. And then he explained it was the same two men who'd later been slain. When Jacinda and I spoke to Marion, her memory of this encounter with Titus had still been clear.
He described the fact that how stupid the police were, the sheriff's department, whoever, was, because he was the one who found the rifle propped up against a tree. And all the while he was talking, he got just extremely agitated and red in the face and was talking really fast and sputtering. And it was almost like he was having a sexual orgasm, you know, the way he was just getting all hyped up and whatever. And when he left, you know, my husband and I looked at each other and both of us said, "My God, it sounds like he did it."
Marion says that Titus's agitation had not been directed their way, but the entire encounter had made her and her husband extremely uncomfortable.
You know, he even said things like, you know, he saw these murdered men laying there.
Oh, he saw them.
That's what he said.
Did he say, like, describe them at all, or?
My memory says that they, you know, they had been shot in the back and they were, you know, like down on the ground, more face down.
Yeah.
And it was like, how would he know that?
As soon as Titus had dropped off his lumber and left the sawmill, Marion and Lee had contacted Sergeant Marty Johnson at the Kalamazoo County Sheriff's Department to report the encounter.
Marty had said, "Well, we've got it under control. We know he did it. You know, he's under suspicion. Thanks anyway." I think we talked with a detective much later than that.
About 10 years later.
Yeah. When I was working at the VA, a detective came to my office and he wanted to talk more about it.
The report that Marion and her husband say they made in 1990 is missing. When the cold case team asked Sergeant Marty Johnson about it, he told them he did recall Lee Gibbs making a report, but he doesn't know what would have happened to the paperwork. Still, Even without that report, Marion and Lee were able to corroborate the other's testimony. In fact, they were the only witnesses at Jeff Titus's trial who testified about a conversation they'd had with Titus and for whom the prosecution could offer corroborating evidence of another witness who could confirm that the conversation had in fact happened. Both she and her husband had heard Titus make these statements, Marion told us. And she was clear, it had been only her and her husband that had heard these statements.
Yeah, so was there anyone else who was there, like, who heard? It was you and your husband?
It was just my husband and myself.
Was, like, any employees there, or?
No. I'm the employee.
Marion's memory is a bit off here, though. She was not the sawmill's only employee.
Was there a guy named Steve McCumber or McCumber?
Steve McCumber.
McCumber.
Yeah.
Was he there, or was he working?
Steve might have been here, but he didn't talk with Jeff.
Okay.
Lee Gibbs had a partner who helped him run the sawmill, a guy named Steve McCumber. He'd been interviewed by the cold case team twice, and he told them about a strange conversation he and Lee had at the sawmill with Jeff Titus. He had not been called to testify at trial, though. Jacinda and I had interviewed Steve a few weeks before we talked to Marion, though Steve hadn't wanted our interview to be recorded. In fact, I don't think he much wanted to speak to us at all. He had been wary of us, openly skeptical of our intentions, and equally open about his belief that Jeff Titus was probably guilty, though he acknowledged he didn't know too much about the case. But he had agreed to talk to us, though he started off the conversation by telling us, "I want to make sure I'm not exonerating anyone here by talking to you." Steve said he knew that Lee Gibbs had testified at Titus's trial, but he'd never thought it strange that he hadn't been asked to testify as well. It made sense to him that he hadn't been called. Lee had been the owner of the sawmill, after all, and he assumed that the prosecutor wouldn't have needed more than one witness to testify about a single conversation. But then Steve mentioned something that was puzzling. Lee's wife, Marion, he said, she probably would have seen some of the trial. She would likely have gone with her husband to court, since Lee had to testify. But then Steve added, quote, "she wouldn't have been on the witness stand, obviously." That didn't seem obvious to me at all, given that she had in fact been on the witness stand. So I asked him, was Marion there on this day when he'd had this conversation with Jeff Titus? No, he said, she wasn't there. That's when I told him Marion had testified at Titus's trial, and that she'd said on the stand that she had been at the sawmill on the day Jeff Titus came by and talked about the murders.
Do you think he really didn't know she testified?
Seemed like he did not know. He also seemed like maybe he wished he hadn't said it.
Later on, Steve McCumber agreed to do a recorded interview with us.
What I remember is, you know, Lee and I worked in the sawmill. We ran a sawmill together. We did other stuff, too. Mr. Titus, one of those people, just pulled into the yard one day and says, I understand you guys, you know, cut up lumber. And he had, I don't know, a trailer in the back of a truck or whatever. But, I mean, he had some logs that he wanted sawed and gave whatever dimension he wanted them sawed into. So Jeff is a new customer for us. And we typically, to develop a relationship, you know, you're diligence with a customer. You talk to them, you know. I know we'd gotten somehow on the topic of this deer hunter thing, and then he, and I'm not going to paraphrase because I don't remember, but he seemed to go into a lot of details, details that were made Lee and I both uncomfortable. He really seemed to, I seemed to have almost a sense of pride on his perspective that he knew so much about it.
It's been 30 years since his day at the sawmill, and he can no longer recall a lot of the details. But Steve McCumber says, this conversation with Jeff Titus stands out in his memory because of how weird Titus had been acting.
I don't remember a lot about it. I just remember that Lee and I had discussed. I don't remember what Jeff said, and I'm not going to just out of the blue make something up.
But it sounds like the impression or the memory of the feeling it left you still have that.
Yeah, it was upsetting to both of us. I mean, we felt like there was no moral compunction about what happened at all. Like I said before, it was almost a sense of pride in his, the way he discussed it. It's like, you know, it was so matter of fact.
Steve McCumber had been disturbed by his conversation with Jeff Titus, and he'd been left wondering if Titus could have been the killer. But his description of events does not provide the kind of damning evidence of murder that Marion Gibbs' testimony had provided. Steve does not recall Titus describing how the bodies had looked, or talking about how he'd marched the victims off his property while calling them sons of bitches. He doesn't recall the things that made Marion Gibbs' testimony so important for the prosecution. And, Steve McCumber says, Marion was not there when the conversation with Jeff Titus happened.
And you knew, so you knew Lee was testifying?
I did know he was there. Yeah, I did. I had no idea that Marion was going to testify.
Marion did not regularly work at the sawmill, Steve told us. Not if she could help it anyway. And besides, she had a full-time job at the VA. During the day, she'd have been at work, not at the sawmill.
She wouldn't be hanging around the sawmill.
Oh, my God. She was a homebody. She'd sit in the house and read all day long if she was there. If she was there, she wouldn't be outside. She's not the kind of person to go out, even then, to go out and just start grubbing and getting her hands dirty, you know. I mean, she...
When we first told Steve that Marion had, in fact, testified at Titus's trial, his immediate reaction had been to search for an explanation as to why Marion would have told people that she'd been there to hear the conversation at the sawmill.
He's like, I think she was just backing up her husband. Yep, just by perjuring herself.
Lying on stand? That's not backing up your husband.
We told Steve about the detailed contents of Marion's testimony and that she had not been simply brought in to verify Lee's account. Steve didn't have an answer for that. Later, though, he brought up another idea. Maybe, Steve suggested, this whole discrepancy is due to the fact that Titus came by on two separate occasions. One time when he and Lee were there, and one time when Lee and Marion were there.
But I distinctly remember that it was a weekday. She would have been at work, and she was not there when they could drop the stuff off. I don't remember if I was there when he picked the stuff up or not.
That explanation doesn't work, though. Lee Gibbs had been crystal clear. There was only a single encounter with Jeff Titus where he talked about the murders. And in Lee's first statement to the cold case team, he said it had just been him and Steve who were there when Titus came by. Though, at trial, he says it was him and his wife and Steve all there at the time. And it's very clear that all three of these witnesses are describing the same event. But both Steve and Marion can't be right here. One of them is not telling the truth. And if you ask Marion, she knows exactly who the liar is.
Yeah, he said that it was him and Lee were working in there, and he came in one day and started talking about finding the gun and all that. And
no, that's a lie.
Huh.
That's a total lie.
Interesting.
Steve wasn't here, and it was Lee and I who had the conversation with him, and that's why we were subpoenaed.
Huh.
We had talked with Steve about the interaction with Titus.
So he would have heard about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so Steve just put himself there instead of me.
If Titus's defense team had spoken to Steve McCumber before trial, I don't doubt that he would have told them the same thing that he told me. And the defense team would have found some compelling evidence to impeach the testimony of one of the prosecution's best witnesses. Another witness that the defense never spoke to was David Newfer. That's the witness who told police that he'd been hunting out in the Fulton Game area when Titus had walked up to him, told him he was on his property, threatened him, and said he needed to leave. The prosecution had wanted to call David Newfer to testify at trial, but because Newfer had failed to pick Titus out of a lineup, the judge had excluded him from testifying. I'd been trying to get in touch with David, and when he called me back one day, I asked him what he remembered about his encounter out in the woods.
I just remembered that Jeffrey Titus had approached me. First time I ever hunted Fulton State Game Area.
Uh-huh.
This guy approached me, and he had a handgun on him, and he kept on sitting there talking to me or whatever. And he was like, well, you're on my property. I was like, no, this is the game area. I was like trying to figure out what the hell this dude's problem was. You know, very first time ever hunting out there.
David had argued back at first because he'd known he was on public land. He was in the game area. The man had no basis for telling him to leave.
So he told you it was his property. He didn't want you on there. Did he threaten you or?
Well, I seem kind of threatened because he had his hand on his handgun.
Although the man did not explicitly threaten him, David felt like the man might just pull out the gun and shoot him if he tried to argue. Or at least David thinks that's the impression that the man had been trying to convey to him. So David left. He later talked to his brother, who told him that he too had once had a very similar encounter while hunting in the Fulton Game area. So David and his brother had reported the encounters, and that's how they ended up learning the name of the man who threatened them in the woods.
The guy that talked to me after that, and talked to me after my brother, I guess he knew Jeffrey Titus prior to that, and he said, yeah, that's him, or something like that.
I finished speaking to David Newfer and hung up the phone, but about 5 minutes later, my phone rang again.
Hello?
Hey, Sue.
Yep.
I looked at a picture of
Jeffrey Titus, and he was not the guy that approached me.
After we'd hung up on our call earlier, David had gotten curious and Googled Titus's name, just to see some more about the case. And when he did, he saw for the very first time a picture of Jeff Titus.
So you think that's not him, the guy you saw?
Absolutely positive, 100% swear on my son's grave that the guy that approached me was not Jeffrey Titus.
I asked David to describe the man he'd seen in the woods, and for the most part, the description he gave me matched the description in the report of his interview with the cold case team. Red flannel shirt, jeans, no hunter orange. But when Newford described the man to me, he'd included one detail that was not present in the cold case team's report.
Do you think you would have told the detectives back then that the man you saw had glasses on?
I did tell them that he had glasses on at the time.
And they did not record that.
They said, well, yeah, he could have had reader glasses on. I'm like, okay, yeah, possibly.
So you recall them saying they're probably just readers?
Well, the way I described the glasses, and he goes, well, they're probably just readers.
By the time his trial began, Jeff Titus was 50, and he did use reading glasses at times, but he didn't wear glasses day to day and didn't wear them while out in the woods, something the cold case team would have known. If David Newford had ever been shown a photo of Jeff Titus, he'd have known right away that that was not the man he'd seen in the woods. But the defense never tried to speak to him and never found that out. Which means the only witness that Titus's defense attorneys had successfully blocked from testifying at the trial had been a witness whose testimony would have been a blow to the prosecution's case.
There's other evidence in this case as well that someone who is not Jeff Titus might have been harassing hunters in the state game area. For instance, in May 2000, shortly after it had been reported in the media that the cold case team was reinvestigating the Fulton game area murders, two people had called in tips to Silent Observer, Kalamazoo's tip line program. One of the callers identified himself only as Matt, while the other gave no name at all, but both callers had similar information. They'd been at the game area on the day that Estes and Bennett were killed, they said, and they knew who had likely done it. He was a farmer whose property bordered the game area, and he didn't believe the game area should be open to the public. And he went around with a large .45 caliber revolver. Quote, everyone in Fulton County knows this suspect killed them, the caller named Matt told the tip line. And the caller who remained anonymous said the same. Quote, he has threatened hundreds of people and everyone knows he killed them. The suspect has bragged that he doesn't feel any remorse and will do it again if needed. But the Silent Observer tips were not about Jeff Titus. The callers had given another name. The cold case team never made any attempts to follow up in this lead, though, and either the defense never knew about the tips, or if they did, they never followed up on it either.
Did you sit through the trial after?
Oh, yes.
How did you feel like it was going?
It was very dragging. The defense team he had was awful, and I was very disturbed at that point that they were not doing a good job. He was endeavoring to prove somebody else did the crime, not that Jeff couldn't have done it. They were trying to prove somebody else did it, therefore this man's innocent, not we can show he's innocent, we don't know who did the crime.
Once Stan's testimony had been over, he'd stayed to watch the rest of the trial. And to Stan, it had seemed that the defense attorney's focus had been on proving Charles Dean Lamp had actually committed the murders. And to make that case, the defense had subpoenaed the testimony of Norberto Aganesis, who had been a friend of Doug Estes and his stepson Bobby Brown. Norberto testified that Doug Estes and Jim Bennett had known one another, and that on the day that Doug Estes had been killed, he'd gone to Fulton to try to steal Jim Bennett's marijuana crop. Norberto also testified that he recognized Charles Dean Lamp as a drug trafficker that he'd encountered before. It should be noted, though, that none of Norberto's testimony was corroborated by other evidence. In rebuttal, the prosecution called Charles Dean Lamp's mother and ex-wife to testify. Both witnesses outlined various reasons why defense attorney's theory about Charles Dean Lamp was implausible. And in prosecutor Scott Brower's closing arguments, he made a convincing case for why the jury should ignore all the Charles Dean Lamb stuff. Although defense attorney Bill Fetty suggested in his own closing that Charles Dean Lamb could have been the real killer, there was a notable lack of conviction in his arguments. He told the jury, quote, "Was it Mr. Lamp? I don't know. Certainly Mr. Lamp was in the drug business and he owned guns." Based on the evidence at trial, it's not surprising the jury was unpersuaded by the defense's claims that someone else had committed the murders. But Titus still had his alibi defense, even if Stan's testimony had been the only evidence that was presented. And while prosecutor Scott Brower had easily dismissed the defense's claims about Lamp, he'd had a much harder time dealing with the alibi.
Brower did not try to dispute Stan's testimony that Jeff Titus had been with him that day. The prosecution conceded that at around 4 p.m. on the day of the murders, Titus had walked Stan out to a deer blind where they'd been hunting. But Brower argued that Titus had then somehow snuck away from the farm and gone back to Fulton, where he committed the murders, before sneaking back again, all without Stan Driscoll ever noticing. But the only evidence that prosecutor Brower had that Titus had returned to Fulton came from Bonnie Huffman. Her parents were Titus's neighbors, and she testified that when it turned dark that day, he'd been at her parents' house talking to them. From Bonnie's testimony, Titus would have had to have been at her parents' place at around 5:45 when it gets dark. That is also, not coincidentally, the time when legal hunting ends. By 5:45 p.m., if he hadn't already, Stan Driscoll would have walked out of the woods, where he would have seen that Titus and his truck were gone. If Titus really had been in Fulton at 5:45, like Bonnie Huffman says, Stan Driscoll would have known. That's likely why, in closing arguments, Brower made no attempt to address the timeline of his theory, because the timeline is impossible. At 5:45 p.m. that day, Jeff Titus could not have been both in Fulton and also 27 miles to the north at the Shepherd Farm. But that's what prosecutor Scott Brower was asking the jury to believe. After closing arguments, the jury withdrew to begin their deliberations. It was on the third day that the jury notified the court that they'd reached a decision. Everyone returned to the courtroom to hear the foreman read out the jury's verdict.
They agreed upon a verdict?
Yes, they have.
And what is your verdict in count one?
Guilty.
Oh.
Of?
First degree.
And in count two, as to Doug Esten?
Guilty.
In a letter sent not long after his conviction, Jeff Titus had written to a friend that, quote, "My attorney Fetty told me the judge said the jury didn't believe Stan and took Bonnie Huffman's word." The explanation for why Jeff was convicted makes a lot of sense. The jury believed Stan Driscoll, and they should have concluded that Jeff was 27 miles away when the murders happened. And Stan Driscoll, well, it's possible that based on the way he testified, the jury might not have believed what he had to say.
Well, I did not. They called me to, as a witness, they had to, I guess. Obviously, I didn't have any joy in it. I thought I could be perhaps beneficial. I was very naive. I believed they would accept what a person claimed to be true as being true. And when I could say, "I don't remember," that was truth. But that was interpreted as being maybe a person who's trying to avoid an answer. And it was not a person trying to avoid an answer. It was a person who could not remember some absolute minutia of 10 years before. You know.
After Jeff's trial, defense investigator Howard Swabash had spoken to some of the jurors and asked them why they'd reached the verdict they'd had.
The reason is the jury foreman. As I was told by Swabash afterwards, that he said he polled the jurors and all the women wanted acquittal. But he said, "He's guilty. I'll stay here for 30 days.
Before a jury trial begins, there's something called voir dire that takes place. Attorneys for both sides get to question a panel of potential jurors, and they try to decide which ones they want in the jury panel. At voir dire in Titus's case, a few of the potential jurors told the court they were experienced hunters. Most of those jurors were dismissed, but one of them, juror number 176, was not.
And like I say, I wanted that jury foreman. I wanted him because he had hunting experience. Nobody else had any. I mean, my attorney wanted to excuse him. I said, "No, I want him on here because he has hunting experience. He can explain things." But he was the one that said, "He's guilty. I'll sit here for 30 days. At least that's what Swabash told me."
Jeff thought a juror who is a hunter would understand what hunting was like. And so Jeff had believed he'd be able to understand why Titus was innocent. Defense attorney Bill Fetty, though, had wanted to strike juror number 176, and most defense attorneys would have probably felt the same way. there are a lot of reasons to be wary of keeping that particular juror on the panel, including the fact that he was a witness in the case.
Did you ever talk to anybody on the jury?
Are you talking about an individual that I interviewed at the time or soon after the crime? He had been hunting out there. Might not even have been that day. Might have been the day before. I'm not sure. He was in a canoe on Bear Creek, which is right in that vicinity. Cuts right through the state game area. But he was a probation officer for Kalamazoo County.
Juror number 176 had been interviewed by Detective Racima in 1990, after witnesses reported seeing him in a canoe in the game area, either on the day of or the day before the murders.
The defense attorney for Jeff apparently didn't challenge it somehow, or I'm not sure how he ended up staying on a jury, because if I was a defense attorney, I certainly wouldn't have a probation officer from Kalamazoo County that had been spoken to by police soon after the crime out in the general vicinity would be on a friggin' jury. Thank you very much.
Detective Racima is right. Putting that juror on Jeff's jury had been a mistake. He was way too close to the case. But during voir dire, juror number 176 either didn't remember or didn't mention that he'd been questioned as a witness in the case. It wasn't until after the jury had begun deliberations, and after juror number 176 had been chosen to be the jury's foreman, that someone realized his name appeared in the case's witness list. The matter had been brought to the court's attention, and the attorneys were brought in to discuss how they should handle the situation. Although defense attorney Bill Fetty noted he was disturbed that the juror hadn't revealed during voir dire that he'd been a witness, Fetty said he did not take a position on the issue and would not ask for a mistrial. Although the judge asked if he wanted to question the juror, Fetty declined. He said he thought the appellate courts would think it inappropriate to question a juror at that stage of the proceedings. And so, the jury continued its deliberations.
No, it didn't take us long to find Jeff Titus guilty.
That's juror number 176, the foreman of the jury at Titus's trial. He's also the only member of Jeff's jury that we're able to hear from, unfortunately, because the identities of the jurors were kept secret in this case. We only know who the foreman was because his name appears in the case's witness list. But Swabash had been correct when he told Titus that the foreman in the case had been convinced of his guilt.
Do you remember, like, what was the thing that was convincing?
It was convincing of the witness for the defense that was the person, as I mentioned, the person that was supposed to have been hunting with Jeff Titus up in the Battle Creek area.
It was Stan Driscoll who convinced him of Titus's guilt. Though at the start of deliberations, not all the jurors had agreed with him.
He was a PhD, and he was just an avid hunter that had hunted globally, if I understood, a big game. And he got to know Titus. Titus had something of a under-the-table kind of guide service for hunting whitetail deer. And he hooked up with him, and he did, the prosecuting attorney asked him, do you really know where you were on that day? Do you know if you were in Battle Creek? Do you know if you were in the Fulton area? He goes, no, I don't know where I was.
Oh, he didn't know where.
Yeah, he I didn't know where I was. And that was like, whoa.
But you said a few people were saying not guilty until they rewatched the witness testimony?
Yeah, there's... that was their choice. Nobody was twisting any arms or anything that.
It was Stan Driscoll, the foreman said, that had brought the jury to a unanimous verdict. Stan had shown there was a flaw in Titus's alibi.
But if they had seen Titus at their farm that day, would you have found that significant? If it could be admitted?
I'd have to pause, you know. And I bet you... I think what was really apparent, though, they show up, you know, deer hunting, they show up before sunlight.
Uh-huh.
It's often the case. And so I guess, you know, he shows up in the dark and not a lot of landmarks to be seen in the dark. So he assumed that he was in the same location that Titus had taken him before, or the general location. Again, BFD. Know if he was in Battle Creek, did he know where he was at?
So what, I thought you were saying like he was like lying about where he was. It's not that he was lying, he just didn't.
He didn't know.
He didn't remember.
No, you didn't know.
So he didn't know. So that was the part that...
He knew he was out hunting someplace, but he didn't know if he was in Battle Creek. He didn't know he was on Jeff Titus's property, just in the woods somewhere. Yeah, that's where he was.
That Stan had played a role in the jury's decision to convict Jeff Titus did not come entirely as a surprise to me. I thought it was possible that the jury had not believed Stan and thought he was lying about Titus being there with him at the Shepherd Farm. But the foreman said that was not what had happened. The reason Jeff Titus' alibi defense failed isn't because the jury thought Stan was lying. The jury believed Stan. They just thought Stan hadn't known where he was.
There were some people that did have that idea that he was just across the street.
He didn't know where they were,
yeah,
really.
Yeah, he didn't know where they were. That's what I think was the prevailing idea, that when he said, I don't know where I was, and all of a sudden, you could just see all these little light bulbs go on in people's heads. And yeah, he could have been right across the street.
So that makes the whole timing less of a problem.
Yeah.
What the jury had concluded, the foreman told us, was that on the afternoon that Jim Bennett and Doug Esses were killed, Jeff Titus had not been 27 miles away at a farm north of Battle Creek. Jeff Titus may have told Stan Driscoll that's where they were, but in reality, they'd been much closer to home. Titus had a large property, 80 acres in all, with 40 acres on one side of the road and 40 acres on the other. So rather than go somewhere else to hunt, Titus had put Stan in a blind on his own farm, and Stan had been none the wiser of it. And while Stan was sitting there in his blind that afternoon, waiting for a deer to walk by, Jeff Titus had popped across the street to the other side of his farm and committed a double homicide.
I'm curious about that.
I do know at one point he did say, I don't remember, but I thought he knew he was at the Shepherd's farm.
He knew the Shepherds. He talked about them. He talked about how they'd gotten coffee for, where they pulled out. So I don't, yeah.
It's weird.
But he also said under oath that, I don't know where I was.
When I talked to the foreman, his comments had confused me, because what he was describing wasn't how I'd recalled Stan's testimony. But when I went back and reread the transcript, it made a lot more sense. There were a number of times that Stan had been asked where he was that afternoon, and Stan's answers had sometimes been confusing. Taken in isolation, some of his comments could be interpreted in a way that the foreman remembers. That Stan said he did not know where he was. But that's not what Stan Driscoll had meant. Stan had known exactly where he'd been, and he'd made that clear in other portions of his testimony. He'd had no doubts whatsoever that he and Jeff were hunting up north of Battle Creek at the Shepherd and Crandall farms. The farms are close together, and he and Jeff had hunted on both of them that day. What Stan wasn't 1,000% sure of, though, was whether at 4 p.m. that afternoon, he and Jeff had been at the Crandall farm or if they'd been at the Shepherd farm. It had to be one or the other. Those were the only two places they'd been. But Stan didn't know which one they'd been at 4 p.m. And that's why, on the witness stand, Stan Driscoll could not say where he was that day. Jeff Titus has now been incarcerated for 19 years.
But you've missed some big milestones, like your kids graduating from high school and prom.
I was there for the first one, and then she went to college. Then she graduated, and I missed that. And then the other one graduated from high school. Then she graduated from Western. And then I missed three grandkids being born. And I didn't get to walk either one of my daughters down the aisle.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I missed a lot.
Titus's girls grew up without him, and the farm they lived on was sold off. He's missed a lot since he's been in prison.
What do you think are some of the biggest things you've missed? What do you regret missing?
I miss my family. I miss my wife.
When Jeff Titus was first arrested, his wife Julie had visited him in the jail twice a week, as much as she'd been able to. But after his conviction, she'd filed for divorce. Their relationship had had its share of troubles, though, and that their marriage ended in divorce had not been a surprise to many who knew them.
Jeff,
today would have been my anniversary.
Wait, today would have been your wedding anniversary?
Yeah,
oh,
August 11th, 1979.
Wow.
Would have been 40 years.
Do you ever talk to your ex-wife?
Nope.
But she stood by you during the trial, yeah?
I believe so, yes. But like I say, I don't know what was going on with Mr. Swalbash.
Right.
Because he was always going over there and having to make measurements and this and that. Something started. And then he was the one that brought her up to see me at Saginaw Prison. and she told me she was divorcing me.
Yeah.
And then the next thing I know, they're married.
Now, Jeff has no knowledge of what happened between Julie and Howard Swabash, other than the fact that a couple months after he'd been sentenced to life in prison, his wife and his defense investigator had visited him in prison. That's when Julie had broken the news to him. And as Detective Worsema notes, the situation raises some uncomfortable questions for which we don't have answers.
Not to mention the fact that the defense investigators married Jeff Titus's wife after she left him. We couldn't believe that one. And Roy knew this investigator. I didn't know him. Howard Swabash from Michigan State Police. That's just another irregularity. Means nothing, really. You know, people fall in love. What are you going to do?
Well, but it could be a conflict of interest that the very person who was hired...
Absolutely. Thank you. It could be a conflict of interest, however, if the person that's hired to defend the accused ends up not minding that he's going to end up going to prison if he has his eye on his wife. Ooh, I shouldn't have said that.
Howard Swabash and Julie are still married today, and it's possible that their relationship began after Titus's trial. I don't know if there was an actual conflict of interest here, or there's merely the appearance of one. And the answer is irrelevant, really. Regardless of what the reasons for it may have been, the defense investigation into Titus's case had been insubstantial and inadequate. The defense simply had not spoken to the people it needed to speak to before Titus's trial, including one witness whose testimony may have been determinative for the outcome of the case. Because Stan Driscoll wasn't the only witness whose testimony the jury had asked to see again, they'd also wanted to rewatch the testimony of Bonnie Huffman. Next time, on Undisclosed. That's all for episode 10 of Undisclosed, The State vs. Jeff Titus. We're back next Monday with episode 11, and you're not going to want to miss this week's addendum. So send us your questions with the hashtag UDAddendum.
Amitha Telhan is our executive producer. Our logo was designed by Baluki, and our theme music is by Ramiro Marquez. Audio production was done by Rebecca Lavoy of Partners in Crime Media and host of the Crime Writers On podcast. And music from this episode is by Blue Dot Sessions. Transcripts for episodes are available on our website at undisclosed-podcast.com. They're brought to you by our amazing transcript team, Dom Logus, Britta Bliss, Skylar Park, and Eric Fladell. And of course, thank you to our sponsors for making it possible for us to come back week after week. You can follow us online, and on all social media, our handle is at UndisclosedPod. We're at Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. And if any of our listeners out there have information on Jeff Titus's case that they'd like to share, we'd love to hear from you. You can reach us at undisclosedpodcast@gmail.com, or you can call and leave a message at 410-205-5563. That's all for this week, and thanks so much for listening.